which you can't imagine why, you know, a leader of society would have to know these things. But well, you can understand it if you understand that this is actually Kabbalistic doctrine.
It's also very much Gnostic. Many of these things that you describe, absolutely, the reincarnation, the hatred of the Old, right, Testament God, the antagonism between God, the creator of the Old Testament, and a superior God.
Well, Plato is the great godfather of the Kabbalah, and he's been revered that way for thousands of years. I mean, you look at the great rabbis in the Renaissance, and they hailed Plato as you know, basically the founder of their doctrines, and they always formalized rather, you know, all kinds of excuses as to why they could borrow from a Greek, claiming that he in turn borrowed his ideas from them.
Well, as you know, there was a series of apologetics when Christianity took over Rome, and the idea was to identify it as Greek because the Romans, right, had great admiration for the Greeks.
Right.
And Plato was always revered as a key figure in the Catholic Church, and St. Right. Augustine and others greatly admired Plato. And he was in many ways, and Socrates was seen as a experiment by some which anticipated Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, Plato's importance has always been esoteric. And so he's been pawned off to the masses, but the fact is that secretly he's been understood for what he should be understood for. And
well, it's amazing that in the modern world we view racism as bad, we view elitism as bad, and all these things that the Kabbalists push on society to make it homogenous, they then contradict by promoting Plato, who was the antithesis of all these ideas.
Yes, but ultimately he's the root of their plan.
That's what I'm getting at. The egalitarianism and other admirable virtues which are being put upon us are in essence a trap to undo all of those things, which you tie into Plato's Republic.
Yes, but I don't pinpoint those points specifically. There's important keys, things like that Leo Strauss has emphasized, things like the noble lie, that these philosopher kings would have to resort to lies, you know, to lead the masses where they otherwise are not willing to go.
And that is seen as virtuous in Plato.
Absolutely.
What we consider virtue today is very different from what the Greeks considered virtuous. They considered a clever liar to be a very virtuous person.
Okay. There's the Greeks and there's Plato. This is the idea that he was trying to promote.
Can you
even go back as far as Aristobulus, who lived in the 3rd century as well, I believe. There's Numenius. He was much later, but who was the other one? Another two early Jewish historians that claim that Plato and Pythagoras were students of Judaism, and that they derived their ideas really from Judaism, so very far.
What I'm missing is that there's no appearance of Kabbalah as Jewish thought until much after the Greeks, and yet there is appearance of this as Greek thought. Now, if it has Persian influence and Babylonian influence, I could agree with that, but I don't see how that necessitates the idea that the conduit for this were the Jews.
Well, see, the mystery is that mystical ideas really don't... In fact, Jewish culture itself doesn't really emerge till about the 3rd century B.C. So there's a gap there of about a couple hundred years where we don't have evidence of what was going on.
And they emerge in the Greek language. They emerge in the Septuagint.
Exactly. So where's the gap? So obviously the Jews were involved in the formulation of Kabbalistic ideas in Babylon, but then you don't see these ideas emerge until Kabbalah mysticism, until the Book of Enoch. And so what happened in the interim? Where is the gap? And the gap, obviously, is among the Greeks. And if we can point to enough evident Babylonian influence, and then identify that this Babylonian influence was also derived from Jewish influence, then you can see that that Greek philosophy was essentially Kabbalistic.
That's where I'm missing the link.
Why Greek philosophy continued to have such a fundamental influence in the emergence of Kabbalah and throughout its history.
That makes sense to me. And you could view the Gnostics as Kabbalistic Jews. They were Jewish.
They were.
And they were putting, framing Christianity in the Greek language again in terms of, and in Aramaic, in terms of a Kabbalistic viewpoint.
And this is what has happened throughout history. So,
and these ideas of the Gnostics.
This is where it becomes interesting, because what happens is that after the conquest of Alexander, this is when you get the imposition of Hellenistic culture throughout the world. And the most important localization of this effort was Alexandria in Egypt,
where the Septuagint was written.
That's right. And where there was a substantial Jewish population.
Absolutely. There was a quarter. There were, I think, maybe even two Jewish quarters.
And exactly.
Philo Judaeus writes about the destruction of those Jewish quarters about the time of Christ.
Right. Philo Judaeus also wrote an exposition on the Therapeutae. And the Therapeutae basically were a sect of Judaism that were linked to the Essenes. And he describes them in very careful terms, but he approximates their practice to the worship of the sun. And the dying god is the sun, of course. And the Therapeutae then are the conduit for these Kabbalistic ideas to come through Alexandria. And this is where you get the confusion about Egyptian influence. Because Egyptian influence, the Egyptian theme obviously runs very deeply throughout the occult tradition. But what happens is that as they conquered Greece and other parts of the Middle East, the Persians also conquered Egypt. So from the 6th century onward, you get there as well, you already have the influence of the Magicians, or the Magi again. And this is where you kind of get the early formulations of what came to be known as Hermeticism. So Hermes was just another pseudo-prophet of the occult, basically another equivalent of a dying god, like a Mithras.
I would quibble with what you're saying on the basis that so much of the fabricated history of Judaism depends upon Egyptian myths. And you have the recurring themes, which are equivalent to Horus and Seth, and other things where you have Cain and Abel fighting, which is very similar to Horus and Seth, and you have Isaac's children, Jacob and Esau, fighting, which is equivalent, and you have this political struggle. It seems to me that much of Judaism is founded in Egyptian mythology, and you also have Akhenaten as the founder, supposedly, of monotheism.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
It's pretty much a separate subject. Because Hermeticism is early Kabbalah disguised with Egyptian themes. And that's really the key. It's completely distinct from the ancient Egyptian tradition. So that would have to be another subject if you wanted to get into that one.
Well, it's amazing how Kabbalah, as you say, continues to do that. Even in the time of Jacob Frank, he was disguising Kabbalah as if it were Christianity with the Trinity and making apologetics to the Catholics to show that his view of Judaism was superior to that of the Orthodox Jews because it mirrored Christianity.
Yeah, well, you know, Philo Judaeus is the one who's the key in all of this, of course.
Hellenizing Judaism.
Yes. I mean, essentially what Philo tried to do was to assimilate the Platonic tradition to Judaism. He thought the two were compatible, and he felt so because he thought that Plato's ideas were originally Jewish anyway.
I see. That's right. A very key point. Because
exactly.
He was an Alexandrian. He was very intermingled with both Greek and especially Roman culture. And he was an apologist for the Jews to the Romans.
And all the leading Christian fathers, early founding Christian fathers, were students of Philo.
Absolutely.
You can name them. Clement of Alexandria, Justin Martyr. And they basically all represented the attempt to do to Christian to Judaism, which is basically adapt Platonism to Christianity.
And
this is how the Trinity infiltrated Christianity.
And we also
go ahead.
We see the Gnostics, in my view, as being a trap for the Gentiles, for the non-Jews, because they taught them not to have children, which would be the death of the Gentiles if they were to adopt this version of Christianity, which is one of the reasons that the Catholic Church railed against the Cathars.
Well, I mean, I would say that's partly true, but ultimately, you know, the Kabbalah takes many disguises, and Mithraism and the mystery schools were just some of those disguises. Hermeticism was another disguise, and Gnosticism was just another disguise. And I don't know what the reasons were, but that's essentially Gnosticism was just Kabbalah in Christian terms.
What is it that makes Kabbalah so enduring, whereas other religions, Christianity included, evolve over the centuries? But you find the personality described by contemporaries of the Jewish people being very consistent for thousands of years, and the Kabbalah has to be at the root of that.
You know, there's another faith that coexists in this world, but it's not acknowledged, and it's Luciferianism. And Kabbalah is the core doctrine of that religion.
And
so
you find the Jews consistently being revolutionaries. You find them consistently dispersing themselves. The diaspora was nothing new to the Jews at the time of the Roman exile. They were already dispersed throughout the known world at that time. And these things are very effective in undermining other societies. You also have them taking control of the money supply. You have them acting as merchants and middlemen. You have them practicing usury. And this is long before the medieval claim that Jews were forced into usury because they were not allowed to own real property.
Right.
What I'm getting at is there's a consistency that doesn't exist among other peoples. You can't find...
No.
And you think the binding element is Luciferianism?
Well, if for some of them, yes.
Because even the Jews of today are not genetically the same people who were the Jews of Babylon.
Generally not, but to a significant degree, still about 50%. I mean, they've intermarried all over the place, but there's still that component there. I mean, that's been proven genetically. But also, it's not all Jews, of course. It's that Luciferian faction among them.
Well, when I speak of Jews, I speak of Jews, I'm speaking of Jews in terms of being a historical influence and a people who hold to this cohesiveness, which changes little over the course of centuries. Of course, I'm not speaking of all Jews. When you read the Old Testament, it's a story of great apostasy.
That's right, exactly. It's the most anti-Semitic book there is. So
what is the agenda?
The key is the Messiah.
And the Messianic age.
That's what it's all about. And it's the key. The idea of a Messiah and this concept of chosenness, which creates race consciousness. And, you know, really the truth is supposed to be for all people, but they've made it into something that's exclusive. They've made not the truth exclusive to them, but they've made the world exclusive to them. And... So you combine these two notions, and that's how you get a 1,000-year, 2,000, 3,000-year conspiracy. That it's really just a Luciferian plot to fulfill the coming, their perception of the Messiah. That's how you explain the continuity throughout this whole period.
Now, how do you find the commonality of elements in that and Plato's Republic and Timaeus and
because
the story of Atlantis?
As I said, Plato has been regarded throughout the occult history. You see, if we go back to Alexandria again, we have to understand, we have to look at the several schools that emerged out of there. And the principal ones were Hermeticism, Neoplatonism, the ancient mystery schools, the most prominent of which was the mysteries of Mithras, and lastly, Gnosticism. And the four are all identical. Each one of those schools holds to the idea of a death and rebirth ritual, the ascent through the seven planets to rid yourself of the astrological influence.
And that's very Kabbalistic.
It is, absolutely. And it's and it's originally it belongs originally to the mysteries of Mithras, which is supposedly derived from the Magi. So whatever it is people's understanding of the current Kabbalah is, this is the ancient understanding of Kabbalah, and all these four schools held to that. They and scholars call this syncretism. So they see this this period in Alexandria as being kind of a cross-fertilization, but that's incorrect. These schools were interrelated. The mysteries were the ritual practices.
Now we have to emphasize that Alexandria at that time, not Jerusalem, was the real seat of Jewish intellectualism and Jewish power, because they were the brokers of Egyptian agricultural goods to Europe and to the Middle East.
Exactly. So the mysteries were the rites, the mysteries were the rituals. Platonism was the theology of the mysteries. Hermeticism was alchemy, which is related to astrology. And Gnosticism was basically just the Christian version of the schools.
So when they borrow from Gnosticism, all they're doing is re-emphasizing the Kabbalistic theme.
Absolutely. I don't think there's not even a borrowing. It's just it's already an underlying sharing.
And you see the Trinity as the intrusion of...
Absolutely. And to Philo-Judaeus.
And you view it as a breach of monotheism, I assume.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, how did...
It's the reverence of the dying God.
I take it that you're a Muslim.
Yes.
How did Muhammad intertwine Christ as a prophet versus Christ as divine essence?
Well, it's just the Quran is very clear. You see, the Quran often offers two very significant pieces of evidence that help resolve all our issues with history. And the first one is that the Bible I'm trying to avoid the word, but the Bible has been corrupted. So there's things out of place, which helps make a lot of sense when you look at it. Secondly, is that Jesus was a man and a prophet of the same religion which was being taught throughout history, like including Moses and Abraham, and all the way back to Adam, which is the worship of the one God. But that his person essentially was appropriated. And this makes sense because this has caused a lot of confusion. When you look at Christianity, it's obvious that the mysteries influence the formulations. But this poses a lot of trouble for Christians who are, and I respect Christians, this is no attack on Christians, but I'm just going to state my point, is that that it's obvious that it was influenced by these traditions, but if you're stuck on the idea that this Catholic version, this Trinitarian version of Christianity is the original one, then you're inevitably stuck in a conflict of how you're going to explain it away. But if you understand that, and then it poses problems or controversies as to the origin of Christianity, because the influence of the mysteries has caused enemies of Christianity to suppose that Christianity was entirely invented, which is not true. Jesus was just an Orthodox Jew who was trying to revive the spirit of the law, as opposed to the Pharisaic practice that was being promoted at the time, which is a great bastardization of the true Mosaic faith. And he was trying to return people to the worship of the one God, very simply.
So Jesus, you see, as a figure in the lineage of the written tradition, opposing the Pharisees who proposed the oral tradition, supposedly descended from Aaron, but which you view as Kabbalah.
Right.
And this great conflict creates the emergence of Christianity. Now, do you view Christianity as Kabbalistic in the period after Christ? For example, the book of Hebrews, where it says that Mosaic law is dead, and that there is a new Jerusalem in the book of Revelations, that Jerusalem has also died and gone to heaven and become a spiritual kingdom?
Well, I found in doing research for my second book, I found some very, very interesting evidence. And There's a lot of controversy as to the origin of Mithraism, and most scholars believe that it was invented entirely in Roman times.
Well, it was practiced by Roman soldiers. It's noted for that.
Absolutely. It was huge. And it was the most powerful, probably the most important religion in the empire at the time. There was a claim that if it wasn't for Christianity, it would become the official religion of the empire. But the first of Mithraism, aside from the fact that the Magicians supposedly practiced mystery rites, which scholars ignore, was in a place called Komiji in Turkey, which is near Armenia, by coincidence, or was part of Greater Armenia at the time. And the family of Komiji, it was Antiochus the First, who was the first one to erect kind of a series of monuments dedicated simultaneously to Apollo, Mithras, and Hercules, I believe. And this is considered kind of the first great real evidence of any worship of Mithras, and possibly the birth of the mystery tradition that eventually filtered into Rome. So Antiochus IV was part of a network of families that also involved the house of Herod, the priest kings of Emesa, a family in Syria that were traditional worshippers of Baal.
Why would he desecrate the temple and make the Jews sacrifice swine in the temple and convert it to a temple of what, Jupiter?
Something like that, yes.
What was the motive?
The family they were connected with was what's called a Julia Claudian. It's the Julia family that Caesar belongs to, and it created a series of emperors starting with Augustus all the way up to Nero.
And Caligula did the same thing that Antiochus did. He desecrated the temple, and he made it a temple to himself, which was common practice among the Romans.
Right, because a temple to himself, because this family was the primary family for trying to introduce emperor worship into the empire. The emperor being identified as the sun. This is Babylonian religion. The worship of the dying
god. So you see that also as Kabbalah, basically.
Absolutely. And what's very interesting too is that the Julia family, if you look at the if you look at Josephus and the various myth that claims the origin of the Julia family, they come from the Trojan War, but they also come from a certain founder named Julius, who is supposedly descended from Judah. Long story.
Now, if I may go off on a brief tangent, in some ancient Christian traditions, Judas is seen as a figure as important as Christ, because by betraying Jesus, he fulfilled the prophecy. So his role is equivalent to Christ. Do you see that these Kabbalists, Antiochus and Caligula, were doing exactly that to the Jewish people? By destroying and dispersing them, they were fulfilling the prophecies.
Yes, to an extent. This network, essentially, I believe that Paul was an agent of the Herods.
You mean Saul, who changed his name to Paul and supposedly wrote the epistles of Paul?
There's a very interesting article online by Robert Eisenman, who's one of the leading scholars of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it's called Paul and the Herodians. I encourage everybody to read it. It's very, very, very enlightening. It seems that Paul was an agent of the house of Herod, and which basically was a network of four families who were involved in the dissemination and preservation of the mysteries of Mithras.
Do you believe that Herod's family was Jewish, or that he was appointed to rule over the Jews?
They were partly Jewish. They were Edomites too, of course, right?
Yes.
It's again interesting, but because the Edomites are key throughout this whole occult history. But anyway, so I believe what they did is they tried to kill Jesus as a form of human sacrifice, which is typical in the occult mystery, because
in Baal worship.
Yes, in your sacrifice, why you slay your sacrifice, because it your sins, and that's what the ultimate
redemption,
right,
and atonement. So, but with Jesus, you have God's firstborn, which is significant in Baal worship, because people were required to sacrifice their firstborn.
God firstborn, but this is an idea from Philo-Judaeus. Philo-Judaeus was the first one to identify the dying god of Platonism as being the first begotten of God.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very significant.
Yes. And this is how this idea entered into Christianity. Jesus was just an Orthodox prophet who, of course, threatened the whole system, the whole Pharisaic system, the whole fabric of that society at the time. So it was revolutionary.
He also threatened Roman power.
Just by teaching love your neighbor, which was the most dangerous doctrine he could have possibly preached.
But he also threatened Roman power over Judea. There were both aspects of it.
Yes.
But you're calling Roman power Kabbalistic.
Well, Roman...
Just to confuse things, I'm sorry.
Roman power which is very strange. And as I said, they tried to institute sun worship, which is obviously Babylonian. I mean, it's very clear. And then they happened to be... It was Caligula, Antiochus IV... Herod Agrippa were basically a network of friends, and most of them participated in the suppression of the Jewish revolt as well too.
Absolutely.
So
and their children, their I forget his name, Lysias or something like that, was the one who attacked Judea, and he was a Jew.
And it's fascinating because when you follow the bloodlines of these families, they continue to intermarry amongst each other, and they produce some very significant characters. And in fact, the priest kings of Emesa, through intermarriage with Antiochus, with the Roman family of Caesar, the house of Herod, produced a bloodline who continued to be the hereditary priests of the cult of Sol Invictus. And anybody who has followed that Sol Invictus and Mithras were essentially interchangeable. So throughout this time, they're involved in various conspiracies to try to establish the worship of Sol Invictus as the official cult of the Roman Empire. They never fully succeeded. But one of their ancestors was Constantine. And Constantine does seem to have succeeded, but only by disguising it as Christianity. So I'm not sure what the role is of the Catholic Church through the history after that, because the Catholic Church has often fought vigorously against the occult tradition, particularly against the Templars, against the Cathars, against the witches, throughout history. So I don't understand what the basis of that is, but it's obvious that the creed of Catholicism was evidently influenced by Kabbalah. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I think one of...
And this was brought about by people who were in the Kabbalistic tradition.
I think one of the heavy influences on Catholicism is the Book of Romans. And there was very early on in the church a fear that chosenness would transfer from the Gentiles back to the Jews, and that the branch which was grafted on would then be cut off, and the lineage of true worship of God and God's grace would go back to the Jews. And that is one of the reasons why the Catholics have always tried to preserve Christianity in the purest form as they view it, and have always opposed Jews, because there is this underlying fear that it may go back to the Jews. And the Protestants, especially today, are fulfilling that fear of the Catholics.
Yeah.
Just the restoration of the Jews to Palestine is something that the Catholics always opposed, and that the Protestants always supported.
Yeah. So, like I say, it's a convoluted issue.
The
goal of the Illuminati is to overthrow Christianity once and for all.
In your view, how is it that the Kabbalists were able to influence and gain control of governments? You're identifying a couple of things. Common elements. They create religious books. They attribute them to certain people. Within these religious books, you have cultural, sociological, historical, and prophetic elements that are congruous and support one another.
Yeah.
You have the flow of money from one empire to another, followed by the flow of Jews from one empire to another. You have the movement of the Jews from Babylon to Palestine to Alexandria to Rome, etc.
Yeah.
So is it this, how are they able to dominate is the real question. And you have the underlying messianic belief and the belief, supremacist belief, that they are the chosen. Now, you believe that those forces are so powerful that they could allow a minority population to dominate the thought processes of foreign people throughout all of the history of so-called Western civilization, to dominate today to the point of creating the mythology of Western civilization.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? Is that when you, if you look back in time, they were often influencing a minority, and it's only in our time that the history has been flipped upside down and fixed to highlight the people who have been prominent in that tradition to make them out to see like they were the great formulators of it.
So they create the illusion of dominance. They didn't really have the influence that it appears based upon what we're misled to believe today.
They obviously did have a tremendous influence, right? I mean, things like their influence at Alexandria, their influence on Christianity, and many times through history. But I hope you can see now that why Greece has been elevated to the importance that it has. But if you look at the true history has nothing. Is my first of all, Greece was an outpost. Was a collection of city-states. It was essentially insignificant. The dominant empire at the time was Persia. But you will never hear that referred to as part of the scheme that led, that's part of Western civilization. Because it doesn't...
Well, part of the responsibility for that, it lies with the Greeks themselves, because they don't attribute their thought, at least not in the censored documents that we have today.
No, that's not true. It's because of Hegel. All the documents almost unanimously attribute the core doctrines of the Greek philosophers to the Babylonians and Egyptians. You name it. The Diogenes of the philosophers will refer to them as many of them. You look at Plutarch. I mean, so many of the, especially most of the biographers of Pythagoras will claim that he studied in Babylon. It was a consistent claim throughout history until basically the time of Hegel. It was a consistent claim right up through the Renaissance until Hegel. Hegel is the one who led to that misinterpretation.
And the Christian Church Fathers acknowledge that? And the Neoplatonic apologists?
Well, yeah, in a sense, indirectly. They didn't want to. They were trying to color it as benign as possible, so that they could they could continue with that, their project. But essentially, yes, it was a common idea. Yeah, throughout the Mysteries as well, it was known to have been derived. I mean, the Mysteries of Mithras was commonly accepted that Mysteries of Mithras were derived from the Magi, from the Babylonian Magi.
Well, I think that the reason of the reasons that the Greeks
So the real history would be Persia, then Rome, and after the Persian Empire, the Arab Empire, after the Arab Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and then Europe.
But
that is the real chain of empires that led to ours. But it doesn't fit politically, because the core myth that is necessary is a dichotomy between East and West, a long-standing struggle between reason and theology, between reason and theocracy. That's ultimately the myth that they're trying to promote. These are the kinds of myths that the current Hegelians, like Samuel Huntington, Fukuyama, are trying to promote, this end of history and class of civilizations. Because this is ultimately what the myth of Western civilization is trying to promote. Well, we today, as a society, are the end product of 2,500 years of intellectual evolution towards secularism, towards our current method of democracy. Whereas the East is the long-standing bastion of barbarism, of that clings to superstition, that refuses to abandon religion and take hold of reason instead. So it's
now you're paraphrasing the viewpoint of these authors. You're not asserting this as your viewpoint.
No, absolutely not.
Now
this is basically what Fukuyama calls the end of history. So So who's the inevitable enemy? Islam is the inevitable enemy of 2,000 years of intellectual Kabbalistic progress.
We saw that in the Ottoman Empire, because those who tried to destroy Islam were the Young Turks, and the Young Turks pursued the ideal of logical positivism. Which
Young Turks were Shabbatean Jews. They were now members of the Domnei sect, who were secret Jews who derived from Shabbatei Zevi.
Absolutely, and they hailed mostly from Salonika.
That's right.
Yes, I've written a book about it. And
oh, yeah.
It's called The Jewish Genocide of Armenian Christians.
Of course, right.
Now, the prescription that they had for Turkish society in a post-Islamic world was exactly what you described. It's Plato's
right.
Republic.
Right.
Where you have a class of elites, you have the destruction of religion, you have a deceptive government which condescendingly cares for its people. You have the destruction of all the true history and the cultural evolution of the people and supplanting it with something else.
Right.
Now there's a direct line of the evolution of that from Plato to Bacon to the logical positivists
Absolutely.
Of Vienna.
Absolutely.
Can you fill in some of those gaps and how the Kabbalists tried to throw the world back to the ancient world as though that were progress in the Renaissance and then in the Enlightenment, supplanted the idea of religion with the idea of reason?
Well, it's all, Isaac Luria preached that you don't sit around and wait for the Messiah, you have to actively work to prepare his coming. And this is key, and this is what they all went about doing. And
Who Isaac Luria is. I think he was half Sephardic, half Ashkenazi, and he wrote a book of Kabbalah which went beyond the Zohar and formulated a whole cosmology and a belief in man as being divine. Not man, but the Jews.
Yeah, and a sort of a community project of repairing the shattered condition of the universe,
and essentially to restore order.
The Kabbalists are repairing the universe and bringing it back to its ultimate order.
To its order, which is another theme of the Greeks, that out of chaos comes order.
Yes, that it's basically the Messiah.
The Messiah,
the completion of history and the reordering back to the fixing the universe.
What it's really doing,
the Jewish people rulers of the world.
That's it. Is placing the duty to restore order to the world not on God, which the Jews had traditionally believed would happen, that God would lead the Jewish people back, but making it a political process,
a
religious duty. And you had, as the culmination of the Lurian Kabbalah, the emergence of Shabbatai Tsevi saying, "I am this man."
That's right.
And then you have from him this ancient idea of Pythagoras and Plato of reincarnation. And you have the reincarnation of Shabbatai Tsevi into Baruch Yah Russo, into Jacob Frank, and I believe down through to the Rothschilds.
And down through his Islamic terrorism.
Now, explain yourself, please.
Well, Jacob Frank...
Another important element of the Lurian Kabbalah is that it was revolutionary. It became communism and the idea that the Jews had to be revolutionaries and subvert all other societies. They had to weaken everybody else so that they could then assert themselves as the emerging power.
I would say more specifically that it's the root of nihilism.
Yes.
And nihilism believes in the creative power of destruction.
Yes, it preaches that evil is good.
Yes, and that violence by a vanguard is necessary to bring about revolutionary change, which is the origin of terrorism.
And the spreading of evil.
There is a specific occult link between, ranging directly from Jacob Frank right through to modern-day Islamic terrorist groups.
And what is the common... Who is it that carries this bucket? of slop from Jacob Frank to modern terrorism. When you say Islamic terrorism, you're putting the onus on Muslims, and I don't believe that's the reality of it.
Well, most Islamic fundamentalism worldwide is being coordinated by the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood basically was originally a Freemasonic organization that grew out of this